Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. Many ambitious people aspire to build a truly successful business. Inevitably, only some succeed. Yet to start with a small buyout, which nearly 40 years later has evolved into one of the UK's largest asset management groups, with over 500 billion in assets, employing 10,000 people, and with offices in 50 cities, as well as being a member of the FTSE 100, is extraordinary. So to talk about the asset management industry and his own particular story, we've gone north to Scotland, which, as J.K. Rowling observed, is one of the most hauntingly beautiful places in the world. But September is here, and as Billy Connolly famously quipped, there are two seasons in Scotland, June and winter. So with an economic chill firmly upon us, I'm delighted to have the man who built and ran Aberdeen Asset Management, which became Standard Life Aberdeen, here as our guest on the Money Maze podcast. Martin Gilbert, welcome.
No, looking forward to chatting.
Fantastic. Well, let's start with your early life. I think you were born in Malaysia and your father was a plantation owner. So what stands out in your childhood?
Yeah, he wasn't an owner. He was working on the plantations, which were mainly populated by Scots. I remember it. I remember it well. I was there till I was about 10, then went back to boarding school in Scotland. What stands out is just I realized then that Asia was going to be the real engine of world growth. And I still think it's going to be the real engine of world growth over the next sort of 50-100 years. I remember traveling backwards and forwards to boarding school in Aberdeen, which, as Billy Connolly quite rightly summed up, has the two seasons, June and winter. So it was a very happy childhood and really gave me the international perspective, probably, that helped the team and I when we were building Aberdeen.
So you were educated at Robert Gordon's College in Aberdeen and then the University of Aberdeen, and I think you had a LLB in law and MA in accountancy, and we're in the same law school or the same year as Alistair Darling. But how do you go from those degrees to a few years later buying with two of your colleagues an asset management business?
I became a chartered accountant and I always loved accountancy. I wasn't particularly suited to the law. My two colleagues who were older than me, and I was their assistant really, were looking for a chartered accountant with a law degree to become a partner in the law firm. So that was how it all started. And then we bought it out of the law firm. All asset management companies in Scotland either started as accountants or lawyers. So Baillie Gifford was a firm of lawyers. We were a firm of lawyers. Ivory and Syme were a firm of accountants. So historically in Scotland, the asset managers came out of these institutions.
So then starts an extraordinary passage of growth, a lot of it by acquisition. It's been written, and I'll quote, in the canny corridors of Scottish fund management, Martin Gilbert has stood out as an ebullient, gregarious character with a passion and aptitude for bold deal making. Now, obviously, along the way, you acquired a lot of asset management business from the banks. I think Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, RBS. And I guess on this growth journey, how much of it was reacting to opportunity as opposed to sort of the master plan? Serendipity or strategy?
I think more reacting to the opportunity rather than, I mean, there was a broad grand strategy, which was to get bigger, but certainly it was opportunistic that they became available. And to a certain extent, we hopefully made a lot of mistakes earlier in our careers and tried not to make the same mistakes again when we were doing the bigger deals, such as Deutsche was a very big deal for us. It tripled us in size. But the deal earlier, a couple of years earlier with Edinburgh Fund Managers, during when we were in difficulties was probably a more difficult deal to do, and actually brought with it Ann Richards, who became our CIO. And all these acquisitions we looked at were to keep the good people. So Hugh Young being a very good example, who joined us in 1988 and is still here today, 32 years later. So yeah, we kept all the good people, and Ann Richards has gone on to becoming the CIO of Fidelity International. So yeah, we were fortunate, and it brought a lot of good talent into the business.
Which of course begs the question that merging companies creates cultural challenges. How did you manage it? Because clearly you did.
We kept the good people, and the culture evolved as those people joined our organization. It became a sort of melting pot, and it worked well. Also, if you've got the culture of short lines of communication, none of us had offices, we all sat out in the open plan, all of these sort of things, it became a mixture of the various cultures with a strong Scottish influence probably as well. We were proud of our Scottish heritage and used it marketing globally.
Right. Well, and then in 2017, you did this landmark tie-up with Standard Life. It's an £11 billion deal. Now, I know CEOs are sometimes accused of needing to do big deals to feed their egos, but what was it that they offered you that you thought Aberdeen lacked?
I think balance sheet strength, scale. It meant that we could have a very strong position in the UK domestic market. It was obvious the world was moving towards consolidation in asset management. So both of us were probably subscale and both of us needed to merge. But I think the great thing for us was this incredible Scottish institution with a 200-year history. And I think the merger worked well. We provided a bit of international perspective as well. It's been a great deal for Aberdeen shareholders. It also gave us a chance of making the generational change that we needed to make at Aberdeen. We were a first generation company and everyone was rapidly reaching their early 60s. So it allowed also an elegant exit for most of us to go and enjoy the rest of our careers after most of us had spent close to 30 years at Aberdeen.
So let's talk about the asset management industry going forward. A while back, John Kay, writing in the FT, wrote that the asset management business lies between brain surgery and estate agency, and that essentially fund management firms should differentiate themselves more through philosophy and style. And I wonder how you think about differentiation.
Yeah, I think John's right. And how we differentiated ourselves in the early days was Asia. And that's how we started in the late 80s and the 90s. We grew our business on the back of Asian growth and then developed into emerging markets globally and developed the rest of the business from there. And our philosophy was bottom up, stock picking, pick good companies, meet the management, long term, hold the companies for 10 years plus. You've got to stick to your style as well, because the biggest killer in asset management is what we call style drift. And you've just got to avoid it. And even though you're going through long periods of underperformance, as active fund managers are at the moment, you've just got to stick with it, because it will come back eventually to your style. And of course, most people cut at the point of maximum pain. And for active managers, we are seeing a lot of the point of maximum pain, especially if you're in the value end of active. But I personally think there's never been more need for active fund managers that tend towards the value or growth at a reasonable price end of the market rather than the pure growth, which has been obviously the place to be with passive recently. So it's been a tough time, but you've just got to stick with it and really believe in what you do.
Well, I completely get it. As somebody with a value bias to his own investing, I think it was even the FCA, though, that reinforced the studies that show that in asset management, past performance conveys very little information about the future. And if you look at value managers' track record, of course, and you weren't thinking, as you have suggested, maybe longer term, you'd be tempted to stay away. How do we educate investors more to be contrarian?
It's a tough job to do, because most people buy past performance and you look at the amount of money piling into passives, U.S. equities, we're seeing a dangerous market at the moment. I just don't know how it's going to end, really, because I can't see it ending happily. I just think there's a lot of people going to be left carrying the can, so to speak, when this bull run does end, this bull market, because we're speaking about serious overvaluation in equities at the moment. So it's tough at the moment knowing where to put money. And money's just going into equities. It's just pure liquidity at the moment.
So we're going to come back a little bit to current positioning later on, but what would be the three things you would advise a young person as to why they should join active asset management today?
I think, number one, the industry is a great industry to be in that you're making a difference to people, to people's wealth, to people's outlook on life and their overall position. So I would say that's number one. Secondly, it's a fascinating industry to be in that it's an industry that, as you can tell from you and I, you get better when you get older. So there's no reason you can't continue in this business to your 70s or your 80s, as we're seeing with Warren Buffett at the moment. And I suppose those are the two reasons I would give. It's absolutely fascinating and stimulating. You enjoy every day of the industry.
So Angus Jack, who runs North Capital in Edinburgh, raised an interesting question, which is, what, in your opinion, are the attributes you typically want to see in the very successful fund managers?
I would start with humility, because I've noticed throughout my career, the top fund managers are humble compared to average fund managers who have no reason to be arrogant. So lack of arrogance. Up until a couple of years ago, I would interview everyone who joined our graduate training scheme, and that would be about 20 a year we would take on. We always believed in building from the bottom in the firm, because most of them had been interns the year before. And one of the great myths now is there is a graduate scheme in asset management. It's really an intern scheme, and you really need to prepare yourself earlier to get into the industry. The one thing I really dislike most is arrogance in fund managers. And most of them that are arrogant fail. So they're usually humble. They come from different backgrounds. I don't think you need to come from a financial background. Although at the beginning, a lot of our asset managers were chartered accountants. And that was probably an inbuilt bias of mine, recruiting chartered accountants. So just varying backgrounds. And as I say, the right being part of a team, because our whole philosophy is team-based here rather than star fund manager-based. So important that you're prepared to be part of the team and you don't have a big ego or whatever it is.
So just returning to the active-passive debate, I think the recent data shows that nearly 70% of the S&P is now made up of either quants or passive. That is very different from the rest of the world. How, in 10 years' time, how different do you think the non-US markets will look in that regard?
I think maybe you might find Japan is also pretty passive as well, but I would expect European equities to go the same way. I think the opportunities really are in places like emerging markets, global equities, small cap, mid cap. These are the areas that you can add value. It's going to be more and more difficult as large cap become commoditized to shine, I think. But there's still an opportunity, as we see. You look at other active asset managers like Scottish Mortgage, big, big positions in tech, Tesla, against probably a lot of opinion from peers and probably even colleagues as well. So there is a place for active asset managers who outline their philosophy.
So that leads us to fees. There's been fee pressure in the general equity products with the explosion of indexation. We had Peter Harrison on the show, CEO of Schroders, and he sort of quipped that this is one of the most profitable businesses people haven't heard of. But how does the industry maintain this historic high level of profitability?
Peter's right. It is a very high margin, or it has been a high margin business, operating margins of 40% plus. It just has to become more efficient, especially in the way the non-front office operating costs still are too high for a business. That's where we'll see a lot of focus in asset managers, is bringing down the cost of operations. The place not to be is in the middle, probably, between the boutiques and the big asset managers.
So you talked about the opportunities you see in emerging markets. We had Mark Mobius on the show recently, who, of course, sort of espouses the same theme. But maybe more specifically, for taking a five-year view, where do you want to put your money?
I'd still look at emerging markets, especially Asia. Yeah, Mark's even more experienced than I am in this business. And probably Asia still is where I would look.
But Asia's a big place. Can I get you to drill down a little bit more specifically?
Yeah, I like India. I think India's expensive at the moment. I like ASEAN, Southeast Asia. I think it's got the benefits of the European Union without the negatives of the parliament. China's good as long as you're wary about China. You've got to understand the governance issues there. And certainly drilling down from the below the big state-owned enterprises, there's some great value there in China as well. You've got to be on the ground there doing your fundamental research. So the huge opportunities, China, India, ASEAN. I quite like Japan. I think there's fundamental changes happening there. So yeah, I'm just generally keen on Asia.
So let's switch tack and talk a little bit about liquidity and the underlying assets and the mismatch. In July 2016, prior to you merging with Standard Life, they had a property fund which froze withdrawals along with several others. Now, are we too keen in this industry to put liquidity for the investor above the reality of the underlying asset?
I've always said that this has to be a regulation-driven change, because no one is going to be the first mover in going to a three-month redemption or whatever. But it is absolutely correct that illiquid assets should not be in daily liquidity funds, as we saw with Woodford. And Woodford was, there was nothing wrong with what Woodford was doing, except he got caught with negative liquidity. He got hit by the opposite of liquidity. And then he started running up against limits. So he was unfortunate. Or maybe you could argue you shouldn't have illiquid assets in daily liquidity funds. That's a different argument altogether. Funds which are wholly illiquid should not be daily liquidity.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I know Neil Woodford pretty well. I'm hoping he's going to come on the show, because I think that's a discussion that needs to run some more and be opened up, quite frankly.
And interestingly, one of the funds, this is probably not a popular view, but one of the funds which had a restriction on illiquid investment, shall we say, was doing pretty well. So yeah, I think it's a mixture of luck there and markets turning against him. Yeah, no, I think he'd be a really good guest to have on the show.
Oh, thank you. So let's talk about today in the investing landscape. Now, John Law, the famous Scottish economist, was a great fan of money creation to stimulate an economy and actually to replace gold with paper credit. And of course, he ultimately was the architect of the Mississippi bubble. We've got governments experimenting with extraordinary policies. The new monetary theories are being, you know, not just discussed, they're being sort of positively thought about. How do governments get out of this?
It's a good question. I'm not convinced they know themselves. I think they just hope with time they're able to reverse it. As long as interest rates remain low, they're okay. But if interest rates start rising, and perhaps inflation will bail them out as well, just keep interest rates as low as possible. And I've been a great advocate of governments borrowing money at these 200-year low interest rates. They should be borrowing it 10, 15, 20, 25, 50-year money and investing it in assets or the infrastructure. And certainly, if I was a government, that's what I would be doing. And I know you're going to take a hit on interest rates of whatever it might be, 100 basis points or whatever. But long-term, it's going to look great value to be borrowing long-term at these sort of prices.
You are chairman of the Oil and Gas Technology Center. There's a whole raging debate about fossil fuels. Where do you think this plays out in the future of fossil fuels?
I think two sides to the argument. You've got to look at the demand side as well as the supply side of fossil fuels. And I think one of the weaknesses in just saying we should not mine coal is we've got to look at demand. And we're still seeing one coal-fired power station a week being built in the world. So we need to really try and look at the demand side. But certainly living in Aberdeen and the reliance on North Sea oil and the world, because Aberdeen has become a world oil service center, really. technology is a huge part of what the Oil and Gas Technology Center is doing, moving towards a zero carbon economy. So the big focus is, how do you do that, basically? So they've accepted that's going to happen. It's just, how do we get there?
So I'd like to talk about Scotland and the Scottish economy for a minute or two. Winston Churchill said, of all the small nations of this earth, perhaps only the ancient Greeks surpass the Scots in their contribution to mankind. You're a Scot, you're an investor, you're used to thinking about risk versus reward, and Scottish independence is back on the menu. I think Nicola Sturgeon's own chief economist showed Scotland's dividend from being part of the UK's surge to almost £2,000 per head, and Scottish tax revenues last year were £65 billion, but spending was £81 billion. How do you think about this independence question?
I think Winston Churchill also said, what was it, though? He got three things from Scotland, and I can't remember what the third one, but one was his wife. The second was Dundee was his first seat, which it's hard to believe that Dundee would return maybe he wasn't a conservative in those days. My history is not strong enough. I remember Alistair Darling saying to me, this Barnett formula, he said, what you've got to remember is it applies to everywhere outside London. Everywhere outside London is probably subsidized to the tune of about £2,000 as well. I mean, I don't know the exact figure, so it's just that the Scotland's figure is disclosed. I thought after the last referendum, we would see that sort of for a generation sort of maybe and raised again. The polls are showing 55-45 or something like that in favor, but that's before any sort of campaign and any sort of discussion on finances. So it would be interesting to know what would happen if there was a referendum. But the key elections next year, Scottish elections, because as you know, the Scottish Parliament is designed so that no one party has a majority. And if the SNP do again get a majority, I think they will take that as a mandate to ask for another referendum. But who knows what will happen then?
So let's talk about some of your other interests. You're chairman of Revolut, you've been on the Sky board, and you're on the board of Glencore. Let's maybe just start with Revolut. That's an interesting move.
I wanted to have a use for my jeans, you know, so you can't wear a suit in the Revolut office. I don't think any of them even possess a jacket. So it's fascinating. It's great fun to be back in a business that's growing as quickly as it is and has different issues from what Standard Life Aberdeen had. It's more like Aberdeen was in the early days. You're sort of growing and putting in the infrastructure later to run an organization like that. So it's been great. Yeah, I enjoy it, I must admit. And I think the product's fantastic. The benefit it gives to people is enormous. Eventually, they'll go into asset management. They're already into free share dealing, asset management, all of these sort of areas. So the idea to be the app to give people simple finance. So it's going to be, it's an amazing company.
So we've got disintermediation right in front of us of the banking sector. Does that make you pretty bearish on the old-fashioned incumbent banks?
I don't think so, because they've got the clients. You've got the clients and react, you'll be okay. If you're complacent, you won't. I think RBS have got it. I mean, I think NatWest is waking up to it. Lloyds is trying with the wealth offering with Schroders. The advantage Revolut has, it's got no old computer systems and no branches. And those are the two big issues that banks have. And as you know, it's emotional whenever you close a branch.
You sit on the board of Sky and you're used to acquiring companies and you find yourself on a board now that is being acquired. I know that's now we're looking back, but what were the perspectives you had sitting in those discussions?
I always knew when I went onto the Sky board that it would be acquired. I thought by the Murdochs, I thought it was inevitable. And the Murdochs are great owners of businesses. And as you know, he almost went to the wall over Sky. So it was a very emotional investment for them. And I'm still surprised in a funny way. Events, they almost got it. I mean, it came down, as you know, to a sealed envelope bid between Disney and the Murdochs and Brian Roberts of Comcast. So it was a very, very interesting experience to be in, to be the first sort of really heavily contested takeover bid in the UK for many years. It was a real learning curve, actually. And I must admit, I do, and again, this is probably unpopular, I admire the Murdochs view to long-term owning businesses for the long term. And as I say, they were emotionally attached to Sky. So not getting it was quite a big blow.
So very different sitting on the mining giant Glencore's board. Are you persuaded by the argument that we've got a combination of free money, commodity supply chains being interrupted, and there is an inflation emerging, and the commodities could be part of the next big secular upwave?
We're already seeing it, actually, already in iron ore. So the iron ore guys are doing really, really well at the moment. And that's just China again, China really sort of boosting production. And yeah, I think we're going to see it. Where we're strong is in cobalt and copper, which are big components of obviously the move towards electric vehicles, battery technology. We're well positioned. We've capped our coal production, which we'll see that steadily declining over the years as coal, well, certainly as the reserves run out. But as I say, we've also got to look at the demand side of coal as well. And if we could see coal-fired power station construction slowing down, that would help enormously.
Switching tack, we've talked to some of our guests about resilience. You've had setbacks. When you've encountered them, how did you deal with them?
That's a good question. Maybe you just don't know how bad they are. Certainly with splits, I had no concept it would last for 2.5 years. And I'd no concept how bad it would become and how damaging it would be. But we were fortunate in that we managed to sell the best bits of our business. We had to sell the best bits because those are the ones that people want to buy from you. So we were fortunate. We got really, really good prices for our UK retail business, our property business. We were fortunate we'd holding in Luxembourg Life Insurance Company that we sold for 100 million. So we just sold everything we could. Paid down our debt. Bank of Scotland and RBS in those days were strong and they supported us through it. We did a disguised rights issue buying Edinburgh Fund Managers and then moved on to buying Deutsche in 2005. So we actually came out of it stronger than we went in. You just got to try and go in every day and do what you can that day, not look too far forward, I think.
So tell me about your ideal day. What would it consist of?
Getting up early. I think I've always been an early riser. And then an early dinner, usually with a client. And then in bed early, that's my ideal day. And traveling, probably you're going to be somewhere. Maybe 1 week out of two, you're going to be somewhere else in the world, be it Asia, America, or Europe. I enjoyed the geographical part of the job, as I've quite enjoyed not doing the traveling for the last sort of 6 months. So it's been interesting.
But between getting up early and going to bed early, having a nice dinner, you're missing the big piece that we need to just comment on. You're a talented golfer and a keen golfer. You've joined the European Tour board. A couple of questions, if I may, which is, how does the game grow in a world of hurry and sometimes what appear to be quite old-fashioned rules?
One of the things is one rule is too many, isn't it, at a golf club? I think they've got to get rid of these sort of... there are certain clubs you're not going to change. They're very traditional, and we've got to respect that tradition. But if you want to attract younger people, you've got to make it shorter. You've got to be able to play 9 holes rather than 18 holes. You've got to be able to wear what you want on the golf course, wear what you want in the clubhouse, these sort of things. But interestingly, golf membership has soared as a result of the lockdown. I mean, it's amazing. People have begun to see the benefit of this tremendous outdoor sport that you can play as a family. You can play at all levels with the handicapping system. So no, it's good to see it doing well. The tour itself really needs to get to next year where we can hopefully get back to some normality in the tour schedule.
Which is the one golf course in the world you haven't played but you want to?
Oh, Cyprus. Cyprus. I've never played Cyprus.
Okay, and if there were two people that you could have on that round with you, two people above all else to come and play a game of golf with you there?
Oh my God, that's a difficult question. I've been lucky enough to play golf with a lot of good people. Who do I enjoy? Oh, Paul Laurie. I enjoy playing with Paul Laurie, I must admit. I'd probably play with Tiger Woods, actually. I've never played with him. I've played with Rory. He's just phenomenal. I mean, these guys, they're athletes now. So, yeah, Paul, I played a lot of with Tiger. I'd love to play one round with Tiger.
So it looks like it's Paul Laurie, Tiger Woods, you, and there's another slot, so I guess I'll just have to take the fourth slot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, Martin, that's been a really, really lovely conversation. I'm going to take away from the fact that those opportunities in Asia and the emerging markets are, they're secular growth stories, and they have a very big valuation disconnect from what we see going on in the US. And more subtly, when things are not going well, simply turning up and getting on with it and taking it day by day, I think is just sound advice, because sometimes we just have to muddle through. Although, to conclude, I think, as Churchill said, you have to just KBO, keep buggering on.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely talking to you.
Okay, take care. Good to speak to you. That was good fun. See you. Give my best to Will.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.